It's time for Ecoman and the Skeptic, featuring Rob Fleming and Chris Pastor. Ecoman sees everything green through a pair of chartreuse-colored glasses, while the Skeptic questions
everything.
Now, live from Philadelphia University, it's Ecoman and the Skeptic.
Welcome to Ecoman and the Skeptic. Today's Thursday, February 12th. It's Charles Darwin's 200th birthday and the International Darwin Day. This is Episode 5, Symphony in Green, with your friendly neighborhood green architect, Rob Fleming.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And me, Chris Pastor, living in the best of both worlds.
Well, Chris, I know we'd both agree that sustainability is an important topic, and here at the university we spend a lot of time with the students working on trying to work through these concepts. And this week's snapshot, students are working in a daycare center in Philadelphia designing a solar fountain.
What do you mean by a fountain that spits out sunlight? Or?
No. Chris,
oh.
Pay attention. Imagine a fountain that was connected to solar panels, and as the sun moved across the sky, the fountain would have a different pattern.
So depending on the angle that the sun hits different panels would affect the way the water moves in the fountain?
Right, and this gets to my point that people need to be more connected to their environment.
So your fountain would basically be like a clock.
Sure.
But it would also tell you about whether it's cloudy or bright outside.
Right, right.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
And the good thing about this project, the students get to design it and they get to build it. So they learn about the theory and then the application of those theories in the classroom.
Sounds like a lot of fun. I think you should use some fly ash cement in the fountain design.
I have no idea what that is. Is that like from flies on your window?
That's the ash from flies that smoke.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Well, Rob, I think it's time for
Green News. And Chris, we got to start with a very serious story here. I want you to put on your serious face.
Okay.
Miley Cyrus says her mom's black SUV Porsche is scary. She inherited it for her 16th birthday. It's driving her crazy.
Is it now?
She ditched it for a new set of wheels. She said, I didn't like it because it was bad for the environment and it was too big. And her dad surprised her recently with a black Prius.
Well, I know you got to like that.
I have to, of course. But the real important part of the story here is that she's rushing right out to get her Hello Kitty bath mats to put on the floor.
Floor mats?
Floor mats, yeah.
Well, that's a good idea. So what do you think? A character like Miley Cyrus coming along saying green is good, I don't want to drive big cars, is that something that's going to promote sustainability amongst the youth of America?
Yeah, I think it will. She, for what I've learned now, she's a very influential person amongst young people.
But you think it's good for celebrities to start promoting green?
I do. I think that they do set a role model for people, and those people who are a little bit lazy and don't want to get information on their own are going to look to Hollywood stars and athletes for their role models.
That's an interesting approach. Speaking of role models, a couple of faculty members at the University of Washington and UC Irvine recently came up with a new proposed method of carbon sequestration.
Carbon sequestration, that's the process by which carbon is stored in elements such as trees so they can not go back into the atmosphere.
That's right. Grab it out of the atmosphere and store it somewhere. Their idea is through what they call crop residue burial.
Burial? Dead people? What?
Well, they're going to bury crop residue. So
okay.
Corn stalks, wheat straw, other kinds of crop residue, the things that are left over after you harvest the food component of the crops. They're talking about taking these and dropping them into the deep ocean. When they get it in nice and deep, there's not a lot of free oxygen there. It's cold. It slows down the decay process. They're thinking it'll take thousands of years for these things to decay.
Sounds interesting. I always get nervous. Again, you always give me these stories where people are altering the environment. Do we know the effects that we're going to have by doing this?
Well, to a certain extent. The largest source of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is from the decomposition of plants, right?
These things
that were sequestering carbon, once they get old, they stop sequestering it and dumping it back into the environment.
Correct.
So if we stick it down there, we slow it down for a long time. One of the ways they're trying to focus on this is by putting everything in one spot instead of spreading it around.
So sort of like point source pollution rather than spreading all the pollution
exactly,
around.
Exactly. By having a point source, and if any problems develop, they're going to be able to find them and hopefully address them.
But you mentioned Darwin's birthday today. So putting these things that are in the ocean that aren't supposed to be there, how is that going to impact future fish species? Are we going to have like cows and fish looking things?
You're thinking that this could be a evolutionary force that's going to result in some sort of improved sea creature that's better able to handle the carbon dioxide?
Or more dangerous sea creatures. We don't know. That's the problem.
Dangerous in what sense?
Who knows? We don't know what they might do. They might become corn-eating fish or something like that.
Sounds good to me.
Not for them if they can't get more corn.
Well, then they won't evolve that way. They figured that the large-scale agriculture that goes on the Earth, they could actually sequester about 15% of the current accumulations of carbon dioxide by doing this.
Now, have you accounted for the transportation to ship all that waste to the ocean in that calculation?
I believe that is accounted for, as opposed to burning it down, which is what's done now.
Okay, right. 15% is pretty good. We learned in our first show that from Steve Gann that we've put about 40% of the CO2 in the atmosphere from our activities as humans.
Right, so we could knock that down to maybe 25%.
Pretty good.
Right.
Pretty good. We'll wait and see. And another surprising story here, General Motors, not known for being aggressive and assertive in the marketplace, is getting their Chevy Volt plug-in rolling out in a major city, San Francisco, this year.
Well, okay, wait a minute. You say that they're not known for,
right.
But they came up with the electric car that was almost ready to go long before anyone else did.
And they were smart enough to crush them all, apparently, if you watch the movie.
Well, they weren't able to get it to market. It wouldn't work because of the public, but they were there with the technology.
Yeah, but now they're like almost flat broke, so something must be going wrong in their brain trust there in the top of the tower.
You say San Francisco is going to support this.
Right.
I think actually San Francisco is considering supporting it.
Okay.
I don't think
Thank
it's
you.
Actually locked in yet.
Thank you.
One of the problems with electric cars is where do you go to charge your battery, or even better, swap out a battery for a recharged one.
Right, so you need a whole infrastructure here to support this new kind of vehicle on the road. And you also didn't know, Chris, the GM's negotiating with electric companies all around the country to get decreased electric rates at night. So the idea is you plug your car in at night, pay a lower electric fee, where they're not really needing to generate a lot of electricity. It could be a good model.
And another variation is what used to be a gas station would have racks and racks of batteries that
right.
they charged at night.
Right.
You pull in, they take out your drained battery, they give you a recharged battery, and you're on your way.
Right. Now, Chris, you're the skeptic, but, you know, as a skeptic, I might say eventually those batteries are going to be no good. What do we do with all those batteries when they're done?
Well, that's the big problem, right?
Okay.
The electric car has an issue with the used-up batteries. There's another more pragmatic issue. When I pull into the recharge station and they give me someone else's battery, how do I know if it's any good?
Well, you go when you do cookouts, you go and get your cooking fuel there, and you take somebody else's one. So I don't think it's a big deal, do you?
You think that you're thinking of the propane tank as something
propane
that you can
tank
swap around?
No, okay, not really. And it looks like it's a promising idea. San Francisco is talking about getting a whole fleet of these cars for their city. For their city fleet.
Well, it's an interesting chicken and the egg thing, right? You've got to have the electric cars in place to support the infrastructure. I'm not going to set up a recharge station if no one's going to drive in there, but I also have to have the recharge station in order to make the electric car useful. So there's going to have to be some sort of an allegiance, which involves both setting up the infrastructure and buying the cars to make it work.
Right. We have to form partnerships to make these kind of complex arrangements work.
But if it does work, maybe it'll spread out across the country.
I think it's going to happen.
Sounds good. Last year, in Australia, there was a anxious, depressed 17-year-old boy who went into the psychiatric unit at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne. He was suffering from climate change anxiety. He refused to drink any water because he was concerned about the availability of fresh water and thought that millions of people would die if he was taking more than his fair share.
So even one glass of water, he couldn't bring himself to drink it.
Well, obviously he went a little bit beyond what most people's concerns about the environment, but this idea of climate change anxiety is spreading across the world.
It's a really interesting thing. We know that Australia is seeing the impacts of climate change a lot more quickly than we are.
Well, they're a very dry country.
Right.
They don't have enough water, and they sell all their water to Europe and America.
Right, by making wine or something, right?
Exactly. The Shiraz wine's popular, but that contains an awful lot of water that Australia needs, and they're selling it off
right.
to Americans
and
Europeans.
And this is what makes sustainability hard. Do I give up selling wine to make sure I have enough resources for the future, or...
Or do I lose my mind and go to the hospital afraid to drink water?
Hopefully this won't become too common in the future.
They're seeing an increase in it. I'm hoping that somehow we'll calm it down, but what we have to do is not scare people.
Right.
Well, I think it's time for Street Talk, Rob.
Okay.
This week we asked people, how does art play a role in sustainability?
That's a confusing topic. Art and sustainability, what are you talking about?
Well, we all know what art is, and we're learning what sustainability is, so can one inform the other?
Okay, let's listen to the clip, and we'll find out.
All right, here we go.
Any thoughts about art and sustainability?
The most obvious thing that comes to mind is how art and music continue to reflect revolutions of thought throughout history. And I think sustainability is definitely one of those revolutions. It represents collaboration and a new way of designing.
I mean, obviously in sustainability you can use a lot of materials to produce art.
Well, there is a trend to making artist materials more sustainable. The term of classic art is like painting and drawing. A lot of this stuff and materials are toxic.
Does art inform sustainability?
I think it partly does. Because I think you're going to get the most bang for your buck if you appeal to aesthetic values. If a person looks at something and says, oh, this is ugly, oh, but it's sustainable, the oh, but it's sustainable doesn't, like, make it work.
Music sustains entire cultures.
I think there's a big, I guess, artistic value that people place on things.
Art and music are obviously inherently part of our culture.
Entire cultures disappear and all we have left is their art, which is very sustainable.
Does sustainability rely on art?
When you look at the Greek culture, the Roman culture, what do we have? You know, very little written work, but a great deal of visual work and architecture. Fine arts, mosaics, and sculpture. And in fact, that's the way that we only know some cultures just through the art that they've left, so that's extremely sustainable.
Art has always been sustainable, right? It's about creating something that's lasting. It has to be. It has to be intrinsic, and, you know, it has to be lasting, something that you can remember.
The question I think now is how to really take that to the next level.
To promote sustainability?
Street culture.
Well, the street.
What's not to like?
They're ugly.
I think we're hearing people believe that art is an important component of sustainability, important to its acceptance.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I heard the phrase bang for the buck in there. So there's a complexity here about money as it fits into the argument, which is going to be a great lead-in for our guest that's going to be coming up a little later talking about this topic.
Well, I don't know if you noticed the piano playing behind
conversation
there. Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that belongs to our guest who's coming up after the break here, okay. David Dubinsky.
And David is a pianist and painter and composer, and he's going to be talking to us today about art and sustainability. David's recent album, Recyclical, funny topic there, is available through iTunes.
You're listening to Both Sides of a Sustainability Topic on Eco-Man and the Skeptic, live from Philadelphia University. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on the subject. Please drop us an email at ecoman@philau.edu or theskeptic@philau.edu. That's ecoman@philau.edu or theskeptic@philau.edu. Now back to Eco-Man and the Skeptic.
Welcome back to Eco-Man and the Skeptic. Our guest today is David Dubinsky, pianist, painter, and composer. And we're going to be talking with him about art and sustainability. David's recent album, Recyclical, is available through iTunes. David, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Doing well here, David. Got to ask you, about a year ago, you worked with us here at Philadelphia University to compose and perform Strange Loop, a jazz suite about sustainability.
Yes.
Can you share some of your experiences at the time?
I can, actually. You guys had the idea for this wonderful project, so I actually had to spend some time doing more and more research about sustainability, which I think is one of the key issues here that we're talking about, is basically spreading the message of sustainability. And in my research, I learned a considerable amount about sustainability, which in turn I ended up talking with my friends about and people that I knew about, and sort of spreading what I know and bouncing ideas off them. So as I put together the outline for the project, I took in a lot of people's perspectives as well as my own through my research, and then also working with the videographer and the people in the project. So it sort of created a whole sort of web network of people just talking about these issues and these things, and that itself was a very positive thing.
And David, I'm not an artist, I'm an architect, but I wonder how you take those discussions and then somehow magically you transform those ideas into something that's musical.
Well, in regards to this project, we had to sort of make it concrete. So I developed an outline, and I decided early on that I wanted to do something about history of sustainability, since
okay.
In some ways with architecture and all the people that are out there in the sustainability business, we'll say, those folks have been working with this stuff for a long time, 30 years or mm-hmm. more for some of them. But for average people on the street, we're picking some of that up now. And for me, it was very helpful to say, well, I need to start from the beginning and see how this started. So I developed a timeline approach to the whole thing, and that helped inspire the music that I wrote for the project.
Well, along with the music, there was this interesting component, a live video improvisation. How did that tie in with sustainability?
Well, I forget his name now.
Sherman Finch.
Sherman Finch was, he went out and took a considerable amount, we had discussions first concerning what the mood of the piece would be, what the aspects of the piece would be. We worked on an outline together as to what the steps would be, and he went out and would shoot video that would pertain to the images that we discussed and talked about. And then he had all of this video in the computer, and he was able to call it up in real time against the music. So he would use the outline for subject matter and purposes of such, and then he would bring up video that he felt, he would improvise basically video that he felt fit with the music that he heard at the time based on the story that we had talked about in the outline, and that's how that all sort of came together.
Now we could probably see some of the results of that if you go to YouTube and type in Strange Loop.
You could
probably download the actual performances there.
That's right.
Pretty funny looking saxophone player involved in that. involved in that experience.
As I've heard.
You know, people talk about music, art. There's a lot of people out there that think music and art really has no value in our culture. It's the first things get cut when school boards don't have the money. I mean, do you think music really has a role in our culture, a value?
Well, how could it not have a role?
Okay.
Well, I mean, think about it. I mean, every culture down through recorded time has an artistic component to it,
okay.
Whether it be around rituals with rebirth and rituals of crop harvest and everything all the way up through the present. So, I mean, it's just an intricate part of mm-hmm. who we are as human beings and expressive people. So, you know, you can say that all you like, but now I'd like to turn that around and say, can you separate the two and show me how we would be without it?
I like that, the way that you explain that, because when we think about sustainability, if sustainability is not integral to our lifestyle, what's going to end up? Where are we going to be? So I kind of like where this is heading.
Well, I got to tell you, David, we've gotten a bunch of questions from Facebook for you. This is a very hot topic, lots of different things coming in. So how about we go right to some of
our viewers'
questions?
Let's see what we got.
Tony from Trumbowersville sent us an email and asked, what concrete steps do you see the art community taking in the near future, apart from just simply sending the message? Can artists remain part of the vanguard when the message is more widely accepted?
I believe they can. In many ways, there's a program, I forget the name of it now, there's a program in New York that basically gives artists grants to use materials from junkyards and such to create more art and to tell their story as artists, and it's a way of actually reusing and recycling and sort of talking about sustainability in the actual materials that they use as art. So there are programs springing up like that, and not only do they spread the word as it is, but they also talk to people that, as well as spread the word, they also actually utilize certain practices that we want to transfer into more of society, which is reusing materials, finding ways to use materials instead of just getting rid of them and stuff like that. So I think it does, actually.
Okay.
I find it interesting because most of the time we talk about sustainability, it's a very pragmatic discussion, how much energy are you saving. But ultimately, if sustainability is going to be successful, I think we need the kind of things that you're talking about, because artists sort of open different windows to understanding the world in different ways and sometimes deeper ways. So some of the things that you guys are doing, contrary to my previous question, are actually pretty important to the sustainability equation.
True.
We got Cousin Neil from Wisconsin emailed. As a guitarist, I'm aware of attempts to find materials to replace rare tone woods for guitars. I don't know what tone woods are, but I'll keep reading. Are there similar attempts for other instruments like woodwinds or the violin family?
Well, I'm not an instrument builder, so I can't speak directly of instrument building, but tone woods are the quality, higher quality woods that they use to make instruments so that they have the quality of sound that they have. You don't want to just use some stray piece of lumber somewhere to make a guitar because it might not sound like a guitar. So tone woods are the better quality spruces and such to make instruments.
And it's very rare rainforest woods. And
some of them are, some of them aren't. I mean, if you think about it, way back in the day when they started making violins, they didn't go into the rainforest in Brazil to get something to make a violin. They used with whatever they had.
Okay.
And I think instrument building over the years and generations basically used what they could, and if it sounded really good, they'd keep it. If they didn't sound good, they found something else. So I think it'll continue to evolve. As far as finding composites and things like that, the clarinet company in France, Buffet, I believe they're called, does make a composite that they use to make their clarinets, which is used out of the similar wood that they normally use, but instead of looking for choice pieces of that wood, they actually use the sawdust from that wood and use a binder and hold that together. And they're doing a lot of work with creating quality instruments using composites instead of just finding the trees. So there are steps that I know of, even not as an instrument maker, that this is starting to take place.
I haven't played any of those, but I'd be curious to try them out. Buffet makes beautiful instruments.
Yeah, they do.
Well, we got an email in from Japan. Brendan over in Japan asks, how does David feel about the use of fame to promote sustainability? I don't know if you heard our Miley Cyrus comments. Do movie and rock stars going on and on about sustainability and living green actually have a positive influence? Do you think people will follow their idol suggestions, or does it just create a negative connotation because the average person doesn't want to hear about sustainability from people who spend millions of dollars a year on clothes and parties?
You know, I think it probably does both, to be perfectly honest with you. But at the same time, whether we like it or not, the more people involved with sustainability that takes place, the more general acceptance of sustainability there will be, and it will get into the culture more and more. So there will be some scoffing about people who, like they did with Al Gore, about how he was into the whole thing, but yet his house did not have a lot of sustainability to it, and he changed that because of it. But, I mean, we have no choice, but the more people that get on this wagon, the more acceptable it'll be, and it'll permeate through the culture more completely as we go along. And maybe some of the artists are the first to do it, but eventually it's just going to happen.
Well, we got an email that just came in from Dave, and he would like to know how long do you think it will take until the entire music industry operates via the internet downloads and pretty much getting rid of all physical materials?
I don't think it'll ever completely happen, period. I just don't. I mean, people are still searching out and paying huge amounts of money for old vinyl records.
That's true.
So I just don't think it's going to completely happen. A lot of the youth of today is very much into the downloads and that whole thing, but there's a segment of the population more and more that's going to want something physical in their hands with the liner notes and with the information about the projects, and I just don't think that'll go away.
Well, Dave, isn't the search for vinyl albums not really about the physicality, but the fact that it's an analog recording as opposed to a digital recording so we don't get clipping and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is also the artwork. It's also the liner notes. It's also the having something tangible in your hand that you can put down. People like the process. And I think we're going to go back to liking the process of having something tangible in your hand. Because the more and more that everything is always electronic and you don't have anything, you don't feel as much a part of something.
Could be. We've got a question here from Jerry in Doylestown. He asks, when you compose with green initiatives and sustainability in mind, do you limit the number of ninths, elevenths, and thirteenths that you use in an effort to conserve notes while maximizing sonic output with a minimal amount of harmonic material?
You could use that as a process. Then again, your audience is not sitting there saying, oh, those are ninths, elevenths, and thirteenths. I think that's very nice. They basically just hear your music the way they like it. So whatever process you go through to write that music, I don't think that really has a lot to do with it. And when you consider in Western music, there really are only 12 different pitches. It's not like there's a lot there to even waste or conserve.
So do you think Schoenberg could try to maintain an equality of all of the 12 pitches? Was a good environmentalist in this sense? He was trying to take equal use of all the different tones available to him?
Absolutely.
Well, I think I got to do my job and put this to a stop. We're going to head into our break, and we'll be back with David for some more questions. You can email us at ecoman@philau.edu or The Skeptic.
Eco Man and the Skeptic features Philadelphia University professors Rob Fleming and Chris Pastor and their ongoing quest to make the world a greener place. Rob, an architect, and Chris, an engineer, are co-directors of Philadelphia University's Engineering and Design Institute, a research center focusing on green materials, sustainable design, and community outreach. Philadelphia University, the model professional university for the 21st century, is committed to sustainability through its innovative academic programs and in practice throughout the campus. To learn more about Philadelphia University's unique programs dedicated to educating the sustainability and design leaders of the future through its Master's in Sustainable Design and BS in Environmental Sustainability, go to www.philiu.edu or call 215-951-2700. The web address again is www.philau.edu or you can call 215-951-2700. Philadelphia University. Power to do. You're listening to Both Sides of a Sustainability Topic on Eco Man and the Skeptic, live from Philadelphia University. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on the subject. Please drop us an email at ecoman@philiu.edu or theskeptic@philiu.edu. That's ecoman@philiu.edu or theskeptic@philiu.edu. Now back to Eco Man and the Skeptic.
Welcome back to the show. We're here with Chris Pastor and our great guest, David Dubinsky. And David, we hope you'd help us work through some problems we have here. One of the commonly occurring arguments is about the tension between art and sustainability being sort of very pragmatic and art being very esoteric and in some cases not essential. And somehow, how do we sort of join these, how do we bridge these together and how do we do that?
That's a question.
No, sort of a statement, but go ahead.
You know, I don't know how we bridge that. I think that's an individual matter that people sort of align themselves to by them. You know, I'm sure you'll be able to tell me that certain architects are more specific about their design and more detailed about what they do and how they do it. And it's the same way with musicians and composers, that some of them, or sculptures and the whole deal, some of them are far more specific and detailed about what they do, and everything's got to be just a certain way to be carried off, and other people like to fly completely by the seat of their pants. So, you know.
Well, you know, Dave, George Antile said something like, in the era of the air...
The French pianist?
The French... The
Thank you.
American slash French pianist. He was born right. in America and did a lot of work in France. He said, the era of the airplane deserves its own music. And, of course, he did the ballet mécanique and songs
right.
that involved airplane engines being performed. Does that apply now? Does the era of sustainability demand its own music?
I don't know whether it demands its own music, but it will have its own music by the nature of where we are, because you can't go back. And as just for instance, the technology and the quality of instrumentation and the quality of musicianship has grown over the years, that will be a signature of how things sound today. And if sustainability is walking right alongside of it, then sustainability will have its own soundtrack or its own music just because of the nature of how things work. And artists will be excited about the things that sustainability creates, and they'll want to use them in their art to create music and or sculpture and or painting. So they sort of, it will, whether somebody actually declares that that has to happen or not, that may be, but it will happen whether they
do or not. I
guess
I was opening the door for you here.
For me to do that?
You know, David, I was listening to you talk about the album cover and all the physical objects that come with music, and that's typically the role of the designer. The designer will
True.
Come up with that. And so one of the things we argue about here is the role of the designer. They're not really artists, though, are they?
Why aren't they?
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. Maybe you can help. Do you think designers are artists?
They have to be.
Okay.
They have to have an aesthetic presence. They have to have an idea of how they want things. Now, maybe designers have a list of things that they also have to accomplish
in
their design, but that's just another problem or puzzle. A composer that's asked to, say, write for a movie has a list of problems that he has to solve in that movie. It has to be so long. It has to convey a certain feeling for the scene. So those are problems that are presented to that composer. How are they unlike problems that are presented to a designer when he has to design an album cover or a box cover? We may not think of it as artistic, but it has to be. It is by its nature, I believe.
So you don't think there's a difference between an artist and a designer? In my mind, the artist exists on a purely theoretical plane and has no need to worry about the physicality, whereas a designer has to do something that meets certain functional guidelines that could interfere with the art just because this bottle has to have a top that I can drink from. I can't design
right.
a bottle that doesn't.
That's true. But don't you also think that there's a real lot of gray, fuzzy area between those two, which means each of them has
sure.
to have components of each other in them to be successful in what they do?
Well, I don't think it's both. I make the argument that the designer is to an artist like an engineer is to a mathematician. The mathematician can do math just because it's cool. The engineer has to use math all day long, but in order to not kill people.
Yeah, I don't think that works for artists, though, because a mathematician can do math all day long, but it usually stays in his head and it doesn't become an actual thing, whereas artists strive to create actual pieces of art, and then hence a design element will come into the creation of that piece of art.
So basically you're just telling Chris that he had a bad analogy there, is what just happened, right?
Well, I don't want to say that. But if you think about it, and you know, part of what artists do is they create things.
Right.
And in creating something and bringing something physical forth into the world does have a design property to it by its nature. So you can't completely separate the two.
Pretty good.
I mean, there are many people that will say that designers are just sort of technicians, but at the same time, without an artistic sense of what they're doing, then their work doesn't have the flair that people want, and they're probably not going to be successful designers either.
So designers are really key for sustainability to get this thing going.
One of the keys, absolutely.
Okay. I like to say that key because I'm a designer.
Of course you do.
In particular, Rob's the key.
Rob's the key designer.
Now we got it. Well, David, we're going to ask you to stick around. We're going to get into our mailbag
Great.
Section of the show, and if you feel the need to jump in, please feel free.
This is the mailbag section. This is where we read your comments, criticisms, questions, corrections that we've received between programs. Andy from Emmaus wrote into us and said, I think if you look at a silly question such as, why doesn't the 21st century look more like Buck Rogers? You get one glimpse of aesthetics and sustainability. Just because we have microchip and nanotechnology doesn't mean we've suddenly found cotton, wool, or wood unpleasant. I think the arts in general act as ace bandages for the culture as a whole. Some of the binding that holds the former and the next together is art. Monk played great jazz that sounded like some sort of jazz, even to musicians who didn't like it, but it also sounded frighteningly like the future.
Well, first of all, we got to get our guests to write shorter questions because there was about five ideas in there. But what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think there's one idea here that we don't negate the past, we don't avoid the past in order to move into the future, but rather we have to embrace the two. And art is one of these ways to help us reflect back on what's happened before, whereas technology is helping us look forward to what's coming next. And a good citizen of the planet has to engage in both.
Pretty interesting. Well, we got Matt from Winston-Salem. He writes, I think it is hard to figure out the role of art in sustainability when no one can universally agree on either art or sustainability. Too frequently, the opinions around both are so dogmatic, Chris, that the larger audience gets excluded. I think this is a great letter because I find that people use the fact that they don't understand sustainability as a stalling tactic to really engage in it. I get that over and over again. Well, we don't know what sustainability is, so we'll wait and see, and then we'll act upon it. We know what sustainability is. Is it really that hard a concept to understand?
Well, but we had this conversation during the news section. It's not always easy to know what's the right thing to do.
But we know that there's a general overall direction that we need to be going. And, yes, there's a lot of gray area in between there, but the overall direction is towards being sustainable.
Are you going to make the same argument about art? You know what art is, or you just know what you like?
No, I can't be so definitive about art. That's a little tougher.
Johanna in Vermont wrote to us to say, I find that art and science share a broad, smudged dividing line. Both require the desire and fearlessness to experiment in order to create. the 9th century alchemist Geber wrote, "He who makes no experiments will attain nothing. As long as there are artists and scientists eager to experiment, and patrons to support them, new materials and processes will develop when traditional ones become rare or extinct. Nurturing youth to be creative in any art field can only help them succeed in adulthood. Teach a kid to play the horn and to have fun with it. Someday could make him a successful fiber technologist who invents a sustainable insulating fabric out of alpaca."
Another letter from the obscure references department, I can see where you're getting these. Geber, 9th century alchemist.
Well, isn't part of our job to educate here as well as to inform?
Yeah, education is a very important thing, Chris, and that's why they keep cutting the arts in education.
Well, that's not universally true, but it does tend to be something that feels easy to cut. Because,
why?
Well, I think the thing is that there's not a clean, direct connection between what you're learning in art class and what you're going to do when you get employed, whereas if you study mathematics, it's obvious. Everybody needs to know mathematics just to exist. The art's not as clearly connected.
So we live in a quantifiably defined culture, unfortunately.
Well, when things come down to budget cuts and I've got to remove two teachers from the school, how do I decide which two teachers to remove?
Well, I find the one who can write the best equation and fire the other one.
That's a common approach.
Okay.
Is it the best? I don't know. Do you have a better idea?
No, I don't right now because I know that we got to head into our next break. So, don't we?
We've got a minute, but
okay.
Sure.
Let's keep going then.
Sounds good to me. So what do you think of Johanna's argument that if you learn the arts, you're going to wind up being a good scientist?
I think it's interesting because I noticed that artists and scientists both use Macintosh computers, which always surprises me because to me they seem like antithetical types of people, scientists and artists, and yet there's a lot of analogies made between the studio and the lab. And
absolutely.
I personally have not bought into that, but I'd like to hear from our guest what he thinks about that.
Well, what do you think artists and scientists have in common other than Mac? What are their thinking processes have in common that would get them working in the same direction?
I have nothing. I don't see any commonalities.
Really?
No.
Isn't science about the exploration of new things?
Exactly. Science is about exploring and trying things and seeing how they fit together and describing how the world works. And artists are trying to push the envelope and put things together in new ways to try to create something new and exciting and different.
Right, but science...
So they have an investigative spirit.
Science is measured on... Okay, I agree on the investigative spirit.
We're not
spirit.
Talking about how it's measured. We're talking about the spirit and their thought process.
So, in other words, the type of personality that gets involved.
Exactly.
All right, well, I'm semi-convinced.
You know, so most mathematicians are musicians. This is this weird phenomenon that, and vice versa. There's an awful lot of musicians who are mathematicians.
So in a sense, having music lessons and training yourself in that regard prepares you for the free thinking that you need as a scientist.
Okay. Well, we'll be right back for greenwashing after the break.
Listening to both sides of a sustainability topic on Eco Man and the Skeptic, live from Philadelphia University. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on the subject. Please drop us an email at ecoman@philau.edu or theskeptic@philau.edu. That's ecoman@philau.edu or theskeptic@philau.edu. Now back to Eco Man and the Skeptic.
Chris Pastor, welcoming you back to Ecoman and the Skeptic. Now it's time for our weekly greenwashing with young Professor Fryer, a member of the architecture faculty and senior researcher at the Engineering and Design Institute. And we're also fortunate to have David Dubinsky joining us for this segment.
Thank you, Chris. Welcome, David.
Hey.
This is the greenwashing quiz segment where we will see who is singing the blues. The rules. I'll ask some questions from the news and you tell me if they are true or false. The one of you with the least correct answers will be greenwashed. To remind you, the score is currently tied at 10.
Just a minute, Professor Fryer. Before we start, did you ever make a final decision on the 55-degree question from last week?
Well, I did. I made a decision. I went back and looked. It apparently is that pipes will freeze at around 32 degrees.
Makes sense.
Yep. So 55 degrees seems a very reasonable suggestion, given that... Now, this is a quote from the text that I researched. Another reasonable reason for the 55 degree suggestion includes that 55 degrees begins to start making the line of when people feel comfortable or not in a space. Most thermostats turn off at 55 degrees.
There you go. There's your answer.
So those are the things. So, Chris, I have decided to do the following. I'm going to award you 1 point.
Oh.
Oh, no.
Because it was perhaps a bad question on my part.
Oh.
But, Chris, I am subtracting 1 point.
Thank you. Oh, no.
For poor sportsmanship.
That's more appropriate.
All right, fair enough.
Okay. All right. So, Chris, Rob, and Dave, would you all agree that understanding sustainability in science requires critical thinking skills?
Absolutely.
Sure, why not?
Sure.
Okay, so true or false? Studying art has been shown to confuse critical thinking.
Well, that's a great tie into the discussion we just had, and based on that discussion and listening to David, I'm going to have to say that's false, that actually art is a part of critical thinking.
Yeah, I was going to say, on what level would it damage critical thinking?
Well, we know how some artists behave when they're doing
when they're being critical. No, I think it enhances critical thinking.
I want to say the same thing. We're all saying false here.
Well, it is false. According to the Institute for Learning Innovation and Thinking Through Art, studies are showing that critical thinking skills are significantly increased when participants are permitted to repeatedly view works of art and are encouraged to look and discuss what they see, known as the art of looking.
So don't cut art in schools.
Right. Second question. Changing your car from one that drives 35 miles per gallon to 50 miles per gallon is twice an improvement of changing from 18 to 28 miles per gallon.
You guys go first.
No.
I'm going to say false.
I'm going to say false.
I got to say false, too.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
Unbelievable. The answer is false.
There you go. Smart people.
I thought we were going to get Fleming on this one because I knew he couldn't do the math in his head.
Yeah. Well, per 10,000 miles driven, changing from a car that gets 18 mpg to one that gets 28 is twice the savings as upgrading a 34 miles per gallon car to 50. So it's the opposite of what I said in the question.
Makes sense. If you've got an efficient car to begin with, you're not going to get that much of a savings.
Going from 34 to 50 mpg saves 94 gallons, but from 18 to 28 saves 198 gallons. This was presented in a study in Science magazine to illustrate the misconceptions people have regarding the miles per gallon rating of cars. The authors advocate actually moving to gallons per mile as a metric that provides better decision-making for the consumer.
Well, the consumer could just take the reciprocal.